This week on The Stack, we're very much en vogue as we talk fashion. Stay tuned to hear about the return of an iconic men's fashion title and take a look at a very exciting Aussie biennial. And to tick the newsprint box as well as the glossy magazine pages, we learn the storied history of the Catalan presses. Always the right style for the season, here on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up on the show, we find out more about the history of the Catalan news presses, and we'll speak to the editor of Australian fashion magazine, Love Wand. But first, we hear from the man who had the tough task of replacing the late Franco Sozzani at the helm of the influential Vogue Italia. Not only that, but he's also responsible for the return of men's fashion publication L'Uomo Vogue. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Emanuele Farnetti. But before we hear from Emanuele, Fernando's here to tell us a bit more. And Faye, I guess we should start by reflecting on the fact that it was, what, last year you and I sat on this very programme and talked about, at the time, the demise of L'Uomo Vogue. It's back. Give us a bit of the backdrop to why that's happened, what it means, and I guess what it tells us about the challenge that Emanuele himself faces.
I think what happened, when Franca Sozzani died in 2016 was quite a big shock, you know, because she was like Diana Winter of Vogue Italia. You know, she was basically the magazine. I think Emanuele Farnetti did a great job, but I think at the time they said, you know what, we have to concentrate on our main brand, which is Vogue Italia. So they announced kind of the closure of L'Uomo Vogue, which was very sad. It's a very influential title. It was a monthly men's fashion, one of the first men's fashion magazines, if I'm not mistaken. That's all very sad. But then suddenly this year they say, you know what, there is actually a market for a magazine like this. Of course, Emanuele did some changes. As you can see, Tone, I have a copy with me. It is a larger format. And I think they look more into fashion because L'Uomo Vogue before, you know, they did talk about politics and other things. Mm. But I think it looks fantastic. There will be four L'Uomo Vogues a year. And I was very much happy. And Tone, may I just say something else as well. Vogue Italia is the more daring one. And in a way, Emanuele kind of continued. He did change a few things at Vogue Italia, but he remained with the DNA that Franca Sozzani really wanted, you know, to have those almost political, you know. There was this fashion shoot of a top model with some oil being spilled on her on a beach, you know, so talking about the environment, talking about racism and other issues as well.
So I guess you could argue continuing that fearless editorial approach is sort of exactly what you want when you're going to recalibrate and relaunch a magazine like L'Uomo Vogue. I gather that Emanuele, when you spoke to him, Faye, began by telling you a bit more about the new project, about its new format.
Last year, Condé Nast decided to stop running L'Uomo Vogue for a while for several reasons. By that time, I just joined Vogue Italia, taking over after Franca Sozzani has been editing the two magazines, Vogue Italia and L'Uomo, for almost 25 years. So basically, last year, we needed to kind of see what was the future of the two titles. We started by redesigning Vogue Italia exactly 1 year ago, and then we had the time to finally go back to L'Uomo and focus on a possible relaunch of L'Uomo, which actually happened a month ago. And of course, we're super happy because it's a very, very beautiful historical title. It was launched in 1968. So we're not only celebrating the relaunch, but also celebrating the 50th anniversary of the title, having a lot of very nice feedback. So happy that we were able to do it.
Well, and L'Uomo Vogue remains a brilliant magazine for men's fashion. And there have been a few changes here and there, especially the format. Now it's bigger as well, right?
Yeah, there are at least two or three major changes. The format is larger. We are going to be out 4 times a year, so we're not going to have a monthly anymore, but it's going to be a quarterly. And that is a decision in order to make the magazine very big and relevant every time it comes out. And also there's another major change that it's that it's fully written in English, because we had this idea that L'Uomo can be the most relevant international men's fashion title. And in order to reach a larger audience, we thought that running it in English as first language was the right thing to do. So at the moment, people can read every page of the magazine in every place in the world, and then Italians will find Italian translations at the end of the book.
And Emanuele, perhaps not very surprising, but, you know, the advertisers really believed in the project as well. As you can see, I have the July issue here in front of me. And you know, and they believe, you know, it does feel like a magazine that Luomo Vogue is back. So how was the advertisers' opinion on the relaunch?
The reaction was super for clients was super good also. It was funny for me to notice that we didn't actually need to show them the magazine because there is such a strong relationship between brands and this title that everybody was like happy to be back even without seeing the new Luomo. And it went way beyond our expectation. We have 127 pages, I think, for this relaunch issue. All the big brands are back. Apparently, after they saw the magazine, it's getting even better. And I think that, honestly, there is a room for a magazine like Luomo. There are not many international big men's fashion title, and Luomo can definitely be among them, if not the most relevant one. So brands kind of love the idea of having Luomo back on newsstands.
Absolutely. And, you know, and menswear keeps changing and becoming more and more relevant, like the rise of sportswear. And I think you wanted to demonstrate that in the new issue as well. I think it feels very relevant in a way.
Absolutely. And also we should consider the fact that Italy for menswear is like probably the most relevant country. Italian brands, international brands run by Italian. So having like an Italian point of view on menswear, especially in these days, can be really interesting. And also, as you're saying, it's a super interesting time for menswear in general. A lot of new designers appointed. We have this big sportswear thing going on. So I think there's a lot of things to tell for a men's title nowadays.
And also, Emanuele, you also deal with Vogue Italia. It's so interesting because, you know, Franca Tozzani, the late Franca Tozzani, she was so connected to the title. And I think you did an excellent job maintaining, you know, the relevance of the title. What were the changes? Was it very challenging, you know, to follow someone like Franca, which was so iconic and important for the title?
Yes, it was, absolutely. But, you know, I think that probably the decision of when, unfortunately, Franca passed away, she was such a strong leadership. She was absolutely the face of both magazines. So what I think is that the company, Condé Nast, decided to choose somebody as different as possible from her in order to not to have the new editor like struggling too much with this comparison. So that's why they call a man, different age, different background. I'm not strictly coming from a fashion background, in order to put me in a position of not spending my whole time just compare myself with Franca, which is of course not possible. And so what we decided to do on both magazines, both on Vogue Italia and Luomo Vogue, is to try to be as different as possible, because the comparison with what Franca did is honestly impossible. So we decided to change the two magazines quite radically, of course trying to not to lose the DNA, not to lose the relevance, but also moving on, because it's absolutely time to move on and do that with a maximum respect of the legacy that Franca left us.
But the DNA of being groundbreaking and quite daring, even comparing to other Vogues around the world, I think it remains there. I think you kept that one there.
We have this legacy of freedom that Franca left us, and we are trying to use it in order to, you know, deliver new messages. But of course, this is really the DNA of the two titles, and it'll be crazy for us not to try to keep it going.
And finally, Emanuele, the relaunch issue is already on the newsstands around the world. Are you working already on the new issue, and when is that coming out?
Yes, of course. Next issue is going to be beginning of October, so we need to have everything done quite quickly. Second issues are always, as you know, challenging, because you need to show that what you've done in the first issue was not a coincidence. So we are actually focusing on a couple of very good projects, because, you know, being a quarterly, what we're trying to do is every issue come out with a very different concept, is make every issue kind of one of a kind. So yes, we are in these days putting together contents for the second issue.
Emanuele Fernandi there, talking, Fernando, to you. And that must have been a delight to speak to, you know, a really important figure, I guess, in sort of modern magazine publishing. Again, about a project that we can also celebrate, the return of a much-loved title. That must have been a chat that sort of ticked all the boxes for you.
A delight. You know, Vogue Italia and L'Uomo Vogue has always been one of my favourite titles from Condé Nast, and I think Emanuele is doing a great job.
Wonderful stuff. Faye, thanks as always. This is The Stack here on Monocle 24. Now to Barcelona, where we delve into the history of print media in the Catalan language. With a former president in exile and numerous politicians and activists behind bars after last October's unrecognised independence referendum, the political situation there remains fraught, to say the least. Tim Smith, for Monocle, traces the story of modern Catalan print journalism from its roots in the Romantic movement of the 19th century.
Goodbye, hills, forever goodbye. Oh, uneven mountains that there in my homeland of clouds and distant sky that were identified by eternal rest, by the colour most blue. I would still speak the language of those wise men who filled the universe with their customs and laws, the language of those strong ones that the kings obeyed. Defend their rights, revenge their grievances.
It all began with a poem, Bonaventura Charles Arabo's Ode a la Patria, or Ode to the Homeland. The original Catalan verses were printed in the Barcelona-based El Vapor newspaper in 1833. The poem is said to mark the beginning of the Catalan Cultural Renaissance, a movement which saw writers re-embrace the language and traditions of Catalonia, which had fallen into disuse. Josep Figueres is a professor of journalism at the Autonomous University of Barcelona and author of Catalan Journalism, A Century of History. He told me how this renaissance of Catalan identity, which would lead to the birth of modern journalism in the local language, came about.
It was a culmination of many different factors. The first was the wider European movement of Romanticism. This movement had historical preoccupation with the medieval period. The Catalan medieval world was extremely important. It was a Mediterranean power that wielded influence commercially and militarily. This Renaissance drew on these historical influences, but also literary and cultural traditions to create a vision of a sovereign Catalonia.
Alongside poetry, novels and plays, newspapers in Catalan would soon appear. La Veu de Catalunya, or The Voice of Catalonia, was first published in 1899. And its opening letter from the editor reflects the blossoming regional pride that would feed the Catalan separatist movement in the decades to come.
The title is already a symbol of our work. We are going to create the voice of Catalonia, which is a harmony formed by a great variety of sounds. A harmony which unites the idealistic aspiration of the clairvoyant spirits to the cry of pain that no longer faces obstacles in unleashing its energy. We want the life of Catalonia to be very Catalan. Catalan in the spirit that guides you. Catalan in the way in which it is embodied. Catalan in the driving force of its growth and development.
This cultural and journalistic renaissance was followed by an emboldened political identity. A new party, the Regionist League, gave birth to modern Catalan nationalism, or Catalanism. Newspapers like The Voice of Catalonia were vital in their growth, says Josep Figueres.
They were fundamental. Without these newspapers, we cannot understand the movement of the Regionalist League. The journal that most reflected their vision and their principles, The Voice of Catalonia, was one of the most read in this period. It played a big part in shaping the public consciousness. They presented a Catalan version of the world and of the culture. They shaped a new Catalan perspective.
But this new Catalan perspective would soon face the forces of history. In 1923, the aristocrat and military officer Miguel Primo de Rivera staged a military coup which began 7 years of dictatorship, during which the Catalan language press was heavily censored. The end of Primo de Rivera's power saw a return of Catalan journalism, but it was only 6 years before the politically polarised Spain would see another coup attempt, this time by one General Francisco Franco. Spain's bloody civil war began in 1936, with Barcelona serving as a stronghold of resistance to General Franco's forces. Fighters from around the world travelled to join the struggle against fascism. Among them George Orwell, who in his homage to Catalonia describes that uniquely Catalan spirit of resistance.
The revolutionary posters were everywhere, flaming from the walls in clean reds and blues that made the few remaining advertisements look like daubs of mud. Down the Ramblers, the wide central artery of the town where crowds of people streamed constantly to and fro, the loudspeakers were bellowing revolutionary songs all day and far into the night. Above all, there was a belief in the revolution and the future, a feeling of having suddenly emerged into an era of equality and freedom. Human beings were trying to behave as human beings and not as cogs in the capitalist machine.
But as the war drew on, the leftist resistance to Franco was worn down. This newsreel from the time reflects the destruction wrought by the three-year conflict, which claimed some 200,000 lives.
Even the British consulate in this Spanish city feels the effect of shellfire. City after city get the horrid effect of this civil strife. Building after building is torn and destroyed. Streets, where once peaceful Spaniards roamed, now harbor collapsed structures. Planes soar high overhead. Bombing, ever bombing.
Franco won the war, and victory was followed by 36 years of dictatorship. Once again, Catalan language and culture would enter a period of suppression and censorship. Tony Piquet is a senior journalist at ElNacional.cat, one of the most recently launched Catalan language news sources. So what effect did suppression of the press have on Catalan language and identity?
Really, it's very difficult to ban a language that is well established. That was the case. But there was no press, there was no media, no use of Catalan on radio, TV or printed press. My impression is that the censorship, the repression, cultural warfare against Catalan developed by Franco's regime, all of this made people more able to go on the offense when the time arrived, when Franco was dead. People were ready to be reborn.
And Catalan newspapers were quickly reborn too. On the 23rd of April 1976, the holy day of Sant Jordi, Avui, which means today, released its first issue, once again with that distinctly Catalan sense of poetry.
When a newspaper begins, you should not need to emphasise your mission. The mission is to inform. However, that we have counted 37 years without daily publication in Catalan obliges us to emphasise it. We have chosen the departure date of April 23rd, a national holiday with wide popular resonance. Motherland, name of the simple reality of the land where you live and work, and culture, which in our case is a key ingredient. All the roses of Sant Jordi, April roses too, have always been a sign of affirmation and hope, and they have a colour renewed in this moment of change towards a society that is more Catalan and more democratic.
They did an enormous task of making the Catalan language useful for doing journalism, because the last references of Catalan language used in journalism were from the 30s. So it's been 50 years, words changed, uses changed. So they did an enormous effort of updating the language just to get used. At the beginning, they didn't know how to say things, some things, and they did this great job. So others went into these steps.
Newspapers and publishing continued apace, and today, Tony Piquet says that the only area of stable growth in the region's newspapers is that of the Catalan language editions. But it is political instability that has defined the past 9 months, a period that began with last October's referendum on independence. The vote was deemed illegal by the government in Madrid, who sent their own police forces to prevent the ballot, and images of violence between the police and voters were seen around the world.
We're live on Monocle 24. Hundreds of people are injured in a day of violence as Catalonia tries to hold an independence referendum.
The police from Spain start to push everyone. They start to grab my legs, then my hands, my neck, and they push me on the floor.
The referendum on October the 1st, we all remember. And that's a scar that probably will take time to heal.
And that's being
that hurt is being reflected in the journalism.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And not just the opinions, of course, on the opinions, but also in the news. I can see how many of them bias the news, promoting the facts that are more adept to their editorial lines. You may say propaganda, no? It will take time to heal, really, these wounds.
And while the press currently reflects a society polarized on the question of separatism, Tony believes that journalists have played a crucial role in the formation of identity for all Catalan people.
Catalan journalists here, they normalized a popular language in Catalan. And second, they normalized the public discussion on politics, on economy, the language to convey the public debate. They have it because of journalists, basically.
Catalonia has weathered a turbulent century of history, a devastating civil war and more than four decades of dictatorship in total. But as the region continues to fight over its future, the past 100 years tell us that a printed press in the local language has played a leading role in the protection of Catalan identity. For Monocle in Barcelona, I'm Tim Smith.
Thank you, Tim. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Finally, on today's programme, we head to Australia for more fashion publishing in focus. Bartolomeo Celestino is the editor-in-chief of Love Want, a biannual publication founded back in 2009. The fashion title chose community as the theme for its latest spring-summer issue, featuring beautiful photography, exquisite clothing, of course, but also photo shoots of red roses in unusual locations. Sounds intriguing. Fernando wanted to find out more, so he spoke to Bartolomeo Celestino.
The very beginning of Love Want was myself, my wife, and a close friend of ours who was a fashion editor decided that we no longer wanted our stories butchered by other publications. So we wanted to show long-form fashion stories and show pictures that we just couldn't do with the magazines that we were shooting for. If we wanted to do a 20-page story with one outfit, we couldn't show that. There was no narrative. They kind of just looked like lookbooks or campaign images. So we wanted to have more expression. So we decided the only way to do it was to make our own magazine.
And just so our listeners can locate, where are you based?
Sydney, Australia.
And you also have a career as a photographer. I think you kind of combine both of those. And, you know, when you look at Love Want, clearly you can see that, you know, because it is a magazine that I think photography is extremely important. So do you think that helped out as well in the idea of the magazine?
I think when we first started, we didn't really have any features. It was just image driven. And if anything, that was kind of, as photographers, that's the language with the vernacular we spoke in. And it was very unusual then that people would get it and they'd be a bit, I don't understand, why is there only pictures?
Yeah. Tell us a bit more about the relationship with the brands. I mean, you have amazing brands featured there, Gucci, Chanel. I mean, the main spread is just so fantastic. What's the name of the model in the cover?
Marjan.
Marjan.
She's a Dutch model. She's a wonderful character, beautiful human.
Did those brands, they connected with the idea of the title?
A lot of the luxury brands felt that they, I think when you were coming out of the late 90s and early 2000s and there was a lot of retouching in images and there was almost this process that was a bit overdone, and we were coming from a space where we were just more interested in a more human, emotive message that we needed to give people. And so I think a lot of the high-end luxury brands really responded to that when we approached them about Love Want. And we were fortunate enough to have some of these wonderful brands as founding partners for the publication, which is rare. You know, normally, you don't normally, especially the our part of the world, where we don't have a huge audience and we just don't have the population to support those kinds of things. We were very lucky to have them push us to produce this.
When you found Love One, do you think there was a gap in the market, especially in Australia in a way? Because, you know, it's small population, but it's a strong market for print as well.
You know, Australians have always had a great appetite for magazines. I mean, per capita, at one point, probably consumed more print magazines than any other country in the world. But saying that, we've only had a handful of really good independent titles. We found that they were just reproducing what already existed. which was fair enough. But we wanted to find something that sat on it, had its own stream. And so we were very much concerned with having a platform for our friends to shoot with and a publication that could perhaps bring other people in and show the audience in Australia what they perhaps hadn't seen, because sometimes you just see the same photographers all the time. You see the same ideas regurgitated all over the time. And I wanted to show, like, when I was very young, I wanted to be a photojournalist. So I wasn't really concerned with 12 looks over whatever, how many pages. I was happy to say, let's just put the girl or the guy in one outfit and just shoot 20 pages. And let's try and create this narrative that was kind of missing from fashion at the time. Everything had just become like a lookbook or a campaign image. And so my wife assisted a photographer in London here for a while by the name of Valerie Phillips. And Valerie was one of the very first photographers to just follow a girl through her life, like over 4 or 5 years, you know, from when she was 14 till when she was 18. And then she would create a book about it. And so that heavily influenced us, where we just wanted to show these more personal images that were almost like a diary. And there wasn't anything at the time like that.
You can see that in the story you've done with flowers as well. It does feel quite personal as well for a magazine. Yeah. And I want to ask, in terms of market, of course, you're based in Australia, but the magazine feels very international. It feels like someone in London or Tokyo can read it and locate it. Is that your intention? Do you think your listeners are mainly Australian, or you also have quite a lot of international readers?
Our fashion editors are pulled from some of the best titles in the industry. You know, we've worked with the fashion director from Document magazine, the fashion director from Pop magazine, the fashion director from countless other benchmark fashion publications, and we've never had a problem collaborating with them. And so they have brought a lot of themselves and the places where they are into our publication. We don't really see ourselves as being Australian. We just think ourselves as being global citizens, and we share similar likes and similar values. And so when people see the publication, they're a bit confused where it comes from, because we actually print everything in the UK as well.
Oh, really?
We never really put any information about how you could even contact us. So
I'm glad I found your email.
Well, it's quite funny, because somehow some of the early issues ended up in Japan, and all these Japanese distributors were trying to find us, but no one knew who we were. And then, you know, they would speak to someone in another country, distributor, and said, do you know this magazine? And they would go, I know that guy. I can find you his email. And then we'd be like, okay, well, we'll get back to you. But life got in the way. And so we were a little bit sporadic to begin with. And strangely enough, it created this destination. You'd have to find it. And so the lack of accessibility kind of worked in our favor, because we weren't available everywhere. And then people would find it and go, oh, that's lovely. Okay, I found it. And they would share it, and then someone would steal it from their bedroom. It was quite funny. In the scheme of things, we don't identify with one culture or one country or one place. We just want to work with a family of like-minded individuals.
Thanks to Bartolomeo Celestino, the editor-in-chief of Love, Want, and thanks to Fernando for his reporting. That is all we have time for on this week's programme. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch, drop a note to Fernando. You can find him on fp@monocle.com. Thanks to the editors of the programme, Cassie Galpin and Sarah Miles. My name's Tom Edwards. This is The Stack. Thanks for listening. And one final flourish before we go. To play us out, a track called L'Uomo d'Affari. You can see what we're trying to get to here. This is Emanuele.
Soddisfatto, rimborsata. When you're in a jam and you need a man with a plan, he could take a stand. Supply and demand. He's a businessman, 'cause a businessman.